live from the Golden Circle Sportsbook and Bar inside Treasure Island. It's Cofield and Company.
It's Friday, gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Partying. Fun. Looking forward to the weekend. Now we're driving on the highway.
Here we go, 5 o'clock hour. A beautiful rendition of the anthem, Canadian National Anthem, by a choir. They did the American National Anthem as well. Candy, we're listening? Beautiful, beautiful. They had the shot kind of draw away from the field. They had the flag, the colors. Great rendition. That's a good national anthem, the Canadian National Anthem. And we know Canada is very bonded together in this era. Are they not? The entire nation is together and rooting against the Dodgers. I'll sit down.
Listen, I've heard we're so close with Canada that it's the 51st state.
Well, that's my point. Is I think they're very bonded together. Not necessarily with us, but that was cool. That was a really cool opening to the World Series. We got it going on down here at the Golden Circle Sports Bar inside Treasure Island. Unlike any other sports book on the strip. First of all, the memorabilia is tremendous. Mr. Ruffin puts all his stuff in here. Parking's free. So when you walk in the building and then you walk in the bar and restaurant, you're like, wait, I'm not out $25 right off the bat. Nope. Free parking. One of the only places on the strip. And then the menu is tremendous. They have changed it over the years, but you know when something's good, you stick with it. So they still have their Loco Mocos, the original, and the Cajun Moco, and then lots of stadium food, awesome sandwiches. Over the years, they've added more and more sandwiches. They now have the Black Forest BLT, the Angry Croque Monsieur, as I have beautiful French, you can tell. And what did we have earlier? Well, I had a piece of celery, but I also had a cookie. But we got the app plate, which Andres crushed. Must have been very good. I will say that Starby's Dan, one of our listeners, he always brings us cookies. He brought some lovely hot chocolate chip cookies. So, sorry to James and Candy. We've been eating things. How'd you describe the dirty water dogs early in the show?
I believe it was juicy filth.
I feel like juicy filth right now after downing a pretty big cookie.
No, you also had celery. It balances out, dude.
No, funny enough is I'll show it to the camera. The audience can't see it. The piece of celery is here. Because I panicked for a second, I reached in to the app basket. Andres told me when it got put there, he's like, take some. I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go in and get a Southpaw tender. And it was all gone. I'm like, I'm going to take the celery. And then I started to bite it. I'm like, celery before coming back from break could be really dangerous. There's certain food items that I'm sure you know, because I see every once in a while you have to nourish yourself during the show. There are certain food items that you do not eat coming back from break. I haven't grabbed anything from the Lotus Broadcasting convenience store. I don't know, why am I holding the celery like it's a baton?
Oh, it's making a point.
I grabbed something, and I was trying to be healthy. I don't think these are healthy, but I grabbed one of those granola bars, and I started chomping on it. I'm like, I might die. If this gets stuck in my throat, you know how it happens, Candy. A senseless tragedy when you're trying to speak, trying to kind of go down low. When you come back from break, things can happen.
I know nothing about this going down low. I am a sweet, sweet soprano. I sing from the top of my voice. Were you worried that like stringy celery was going to get stuck? Or are you thinking like it was just going to be one piece stuck in your throat and it was going to be R.I.P. Cofield?
It was the string, maybe at the top of the throat. I wasn't expecting it to get stuck. I also need some hummus. They could bring out some hummus for me. Do you know who I am?
Juicy filth hummus on my plate now.
Bring out some of the Loco Moco gravy. I'm looking to go healthy with some celery in some
dip your celery
mushroom
in the gravy.
Gravy.
I love it.
I'm creative, man. Dipping is what I'm all about. Let's get ready for the World Series. This first pitch is coming up here in a couple minutes. Let's talk to the voice of baseball in Vegas. Also, I got to get some info to Candy, to the audience, and for myself of up close what the Running Rebels look like in their first exhibition game. They took on Washington earlier this week, and they'll be playing Lincoln on Tuesday. Mr. Neverett, Matt Neverett, how are you, buddy?
Hey, doing well. You know, a celery and a cookie is not the worst, especially by your standards, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Well, the celery and a cookie. I thought you mentioned the gravy. I don't know if the gravy works.
No, not yet.
Yeah. Maybe some poutine in celebration of the Canadian national anthem. That was pretty good
en
stuff.
Français.
All right, let's preview the World Series here. Candy, can you run by your whole deal, seeing the this storyline that people are trying to force down, I think, dumb fans' throats about the Blue Jays being the little engine that could?
Well, I mean, I understand that they're big underdogs in the series because of the Dodgers' Death Star, but Matt, I'll throw you the same question that I threw Cofield earlier. How many teams had a higher payroll than Toronto this year?
I know that they have spent more this year than they typically do, but I'm going to guess it's a little bit lower. That's one I don't know offhand as far as where they rank.
Yeah, so they're actually sixth. There are only five teams in front of them in terms of.
I mean,
of
they got a whole nation backing them, so you would hope they're in the top 10. It's an interesting situation this year. It's one of the very few things that I think I've ever agreed with Alex Rodriguez on. He said the other day that people are trying to make it out to be this David versus Goliath narrative. This is Goliath versus Goliath. The Jays won 94 games and had a better record than the Dodgers in the regular season.
That means that you and I are essentially the same person. I don't know that I've ever agreed with Alex Rodriguez, so I understand where you're coming from, feeling a little bit out of your element talking about that. As we look at the lack of David and Goliath here, why is it, do you think, people are looking at this Toronto team and not giving them enough credit for their ability to be competitive in this series?
You know, it's one of those situations, guys, where I think it says more about the Dodgers and about people's sentiment about the Dodgers. I also think it's just one of those where the Blue Jays aren't a team that's been a traditional powerhouse over the last five or so years. They're just a team that not everybody knows about. Not everybody is a big Ernie Clement guy like Cofield is. Not everybody knows too many players outside of Vladdy, Bo Bichette, and George Springer on that roster. I think Alejandro Kirk might have my favorite physical build of any player in the league. I mean, that guy is a hitting machine at all 5'6", 250 pounds. So they're an interesting team with some fun storylines. They've got a really good pitching staff, I think more balanced than the Dodgers top to bottom. But as far as star power, the Dodgers have them as well as just about every other team in baseball beat as far as their top-of-the-line pitchers. And this was a team that had I think it was the third, maybe even the fourth best odds to win their own division. And they turn around and have one of the best records in the American League. And this has kind of been culminating for a while. It's the culmination of a couple of years' effort from this front office. And, you know, it was about time. The Blue Jays, I don't want to say a team of destiny about a team with 90-plus wins in the regular season, but they've been a team that has just kind of quietly gone about their business all year and won games when it mattered in the playoffs.
On the other side, you mentioned, Matt, the sentiment that people have toward the Dodgers. And look, we didn't actually see it for a lot of the season with all the injuries that they had, right? And we're talking about a team that was in a division race with the Padres all the way into September. But in that National League Championship Series, with the way that you got the A performances from all of those starting pitchers, it felt like the beginning of a coronation at that point. Let me ask you this much. Do you think that those starting pitching performances are replicable against this Toronto team?
I don't know about a direct one-to-one replica of some of those, especially the Ohtani legendary game, single best performance in one game in Major League history. I don't know if you can expect that. Now, if Blake Snell can go out and give you six innings, give up two runs or less, and the offense scores a little bit, I think that's all you need. You know, you don't want to have to turn things over to the bullpen prematurely. I think that Roky Sasaki, at least for the time being, has cemented himself as the guy to go to late in games. And because of the way he's stretched out a little bit, he can throw multiple days in a row, multiple games in a row as well if they need to. So I think they've kind of positioned themselves where they're going to ride or die on their starting pitching, maybe not quite to the level of the 2005 White Sox. But like we saw in the National League Championship Series, when their starting pitching is on, there's not a lot that other teams can do about it. And this Toronto lineup, while it is, you know, very good, very steady, it's a little bit top-heavy. I think that the Dodgers have the advantage in just about every way in this series, and while I think it is a pretty evenly balanced series, I've been saying that I think the Dodgers win this one in five games. I think six games max. I don't see a way that this one goes to seven, especially if the Dodgers can find a way to go back to L.A. winning 2-0.
Matt Everett on ESPN Las Vegas. Clearly going into the series because he's the only guy who pitches and hits. Ohtani could be the most impactful dude. Take both teams. Beyond Ohtani, who has a chance to be the most impactful player? And beyond that, is there a surprise upside impactful player?
I mean, it's tough. Like, I was looking at the World Series MVP odds earlier this week on the show that I do with Alex White over at South Point, and I gave out on the air, don't sleep on Freddie Freeman for a World Series MVP bet if you're going to throw some pizza money on there. Earlier this week, it was Ohtani, like, plus 165. I think Vladdy was 4-1, maybe a little bit less. And then the next best odds were a couple of guys at 10-1, including Freddie Freeman, who's done it at this level before. I think people forget that, you know, the Dodgers have this top-heavy lineup, so to speak, with three former and, you know, reigning, so to speak, in the Ohtani category MVPs, to where if you can get Freddie Freeman or Mookie Betts a World Series MVP at plus money or double digit to one, rather, I should say, I would like that bet a lot. I mean, it's interesting to see kind of where the supplementary offense comes from if you're with Toronto. But I think that Bo Bichette, who's really been heating up, has an opportunity to really make a difference in this series in the filling in the middle of that lineup after a slow start to the year. I'd keep an eye out for George Springer as well. I think if Toronto either stretches it to seven or finds a way to win the series, George Springer, I should say, at the top of that lineup is going to have a big-time impact.
Matt Everett's with us as we're getting ready for the World Series. First pitch coming up here at the Golden Circle Sports Bar in just a couple of minutes. It's Candy. It's Steve Cofield. On this Friday. All right, I got to get to a little running Rebel basketball with Rebel football off. You got to see the Rebels up close. A little bit of a mash unit as they have several players, key players who are out, starting with the point guard. Well, first of all, just your reaction to the way they played. They wound up losing by 15. Washington didn't boat race them, but had a lot of size in the game and clearly dominated in the paint. What was the overall feel for you and this first look at this new Rebel team?
I'll tell you what, you know, and I've been telling people that have asked me ever since that I was downright encouraged by a lot of what I saw. Both teams only had eight bodies available, and the only big difference is that two of the eight for Washington were 7 feet tall. And UNLV had Kamani Hamilton starting at the five. He's 6'9", and is probably going to be the leading scorer on this running Rebel team this year. He's likely to spend more time playing the three than he is at the five when everybody's healthy. So you got to keep that in mind. Washington held it down on the boards, but you know, a 15-point win. They were losing by 16 at the half. They led for most of the second half, if you're going to consider that its own game. And I really liked what I saw out of Dre Gibbs-Lawhorn, who is probably going to start the year at point guard if Miles Che isn't available. And also Kamani Hamilton, like I mentioned as well. Naz Cunningham is as exciting a prospect as they've been able to bring in here in the last couple of years. Guy that's a former five-star, transferred from Alabama. When at one point in high school, he was a number one recruit in his entire class. So he's a guy with tremendous upside. I think he's going to be an impact player coming off the bench. Walter Brown looked to be a steady scoring presence around the outside, and he's a guy who's played professionally in New Zealand for the last 5 years, so he brings a veteran mentality and that physicality to go along with it. I think this is as long and rangy a team defensively as we've seen here in Las Vegas in a handful of years, and in terms of the physicality and just the overall explosiveness, what this team can bring to the table, I'm really, really excited. Josh Pastner has said that he wants to get back to that running Rebels mantra, kind of going against what he did at Georgia Tech when his last coaching job, where he tried to slow the game down, but he knows he's got the athletes, and he knows with the way that the basketball works in the Mountain West Conference, if you have the advantage in terms of the conditioning and the cardio, you can run up and down the floor all day. You've got an advantage against a lot of teams in this conference.
Is Josh Pastner going to go with a suit or jacket for every game? What's the word?
I'll tell you what, that's you and I think a lot alike. I asked him about it because when he coached previously, he was full suit and tie. We've seen the coaching trend kind of going away from that, but when they suited it up against Washington, he was shirt and tie, no jacket. Rest of the coaching staff was just in polos and slacks. I did ask him before the game, I said, so what's the plan? Are you going to be a shirt and tie? Were you wearing the jacket? What's going on? He said, for the time being, he's going tie and button up, no jacket. I told him we need the jacket at least once so we can throw it a la Roy Williams.
Who's going to be the one to do this? Maybe it should be Curtis Terry because he's pretty tight with Pastner going back to the Arizona days. Or if not, I'm going to have to do it. What is Pastner doing from a fitness standpoint? Because he is more of a kind of that yoked category for a coach versus some guys who look like unmade beds.
I mean, if you've ever met him, and I know you have, Steve, he's got just incredible energy. I would just say from walking all day. I mean,
I have a lot of energy. I'm not all muscled up.
Yeah, but he literally never stops. And he's a guy who I remember in his introductory press conference, somebody asked like more about him. He said he's never drank caffeine at all. You know, never drank alcohol, never done any kind of illegal substance. Like, this guy is just all natural energy, which we could all only be so lucky. And, you know, when you work in basketball, especially if you're in the gym all day, you're kind of just pacing back and forth the whole day. And I can only imagine his desk at home has some kind of a setup where he's either got the treadmill under there or one of those, like, little foot bikes. There's no way he stops moving when he gets home because this guy has, like, unrelenting energy. And it's very, very refreshing to be around. It's kind of something that I got to strive to be more towards, especially when we go on some of these road trips, right?
Safe to say, Josh Pastner not hanging out at sports bars, eating celery, asking for gravy to dip it in, and chasing it with cookies.
Maybe just the celery part.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the support dudes, who I think can be a lot more than support, but I think they had a little trouble blending in terms of the flow of the offense. Give me your impression of both Howie Fleming and Al Green.
Those, when you started that sentence, those were literally the two names that I was thinking of. They're two guys who both shot over 40% from three-point at their last stops last year. Al Green especially is going to be a corner sniper. I think he's going to get a lot of run at the two-guard. Fleming's a little bit bigger, maybe not as physical, but he's bigger and longer, so he could play some three as well as two. I think right now we're seeing Naz Cunningham, Walter Brown, and Howie Fleming all kind of splitting time at the three, at least when we've gone to practice as well. They've got it's almost like Justin Webster in a sense, but with a little bit more physicality and a little bit more of a presence on defense. And, you know, for those that remember Webby, he was an outstanding knockdown shooter from the outside. So they've got a couple of those guys who are real playmakers who can score for themselves. And I think that's going to be something that we didn't see a lot of last year in that offense, that at times would get stagnant with DJ Thomas running the show. And that's not anything against him, but that was just the way that they had it set up. The injuries kind of predicated it towards the end of the season as well. I think we're going to see a lot more backdoor cuts, a lot more movement through the lane from this offense in general, and I'm really excited to see it with some of the really intense bodies they brought in athletically.
You mentioned Walter Brown, New Zealander added very late in the summer. Give me his positives, and can he actually be a guy who's a knockdown three-point shooter to the tune of, you know, maybe making – these are stupid numbers to mention, but, you know, like 1.5 to 2.2 threes a game.
Oh, easily. And he was a guy that, despite, you know, getting a ton of open looks, just missed some wide open shots in the scrimmage against Washington. And, you know, it's almost like spring training in baseball. You're kind of almost expecting the pitchers in that instance to not quite be as precise throwing around the edges of the zone. In this instance, you know, the knockdown shooters have a tough time going on the road, not playing in game action for a while, playing in a new environment. The arena, Alaska Airlines Arena, formerly Heck Edmondson Arena up there in Seattle, is old. It's small. It's a cathedral. It's just a different look shooting-wise than what these guys are used to at either the Mendenhall Center or the home games at the Thomas and Mack. So the UNLV started 1 of 13 from 3 as well. They were just ice cold from beyond the arc to start the game. So I think that if they were able to get a couple of those shots to fall in the first half, you know, instead of a 16-point halftime deficit, you're staring on the barrel of like a 5 or a 6-point halftime deficit, and then that final score doesn't look quite as bad with the way they played in the second half. I like the adjustments they made. They really didn't have to do too much on the offense, and I think Walter Brown's going to play a significant part. He also made some incredibly efficient and athletic hustle plays, saving a couple of balls going in bounds. He tips some rebounds up. Josh Pastner overall was really excited with the fact that they rebounded 35% of their own misses. That was the number he kept throwing around. He said, if we rebound 35% of our own misses on any given day, that gives us such an advantage because it extends the possessions, it adds new possessions, and Walter Brown, a big reason why that stat was so.
Matt Neverett, voice of the Rebels, as Runner Rebels are going to play another exhibition game on the 28th. That's Tuesday, and then the opener is on November 4th against UT Martin at the Thomas and Mack. The exhibition game's at the Thomas and Mack as well. To get tickets, UNLVtickets.com. I got a chance at Mountain West Conference Media Days to talk to Josh Pastner. If you missed that interview, we'll have it posted up on social media ASAP. We played that yesterday. I was surprised that he actually went pretty positive on a couple of freshmen. It's not that I don't think the freshmen are good, but usually coaches are very reserved. He had a lot of nice things to say about Isaac Williamson and his return coming up, and also Tyron Jones. Williamson is a guard, a point guard. Jones is 6'9", 6'10". from what you've seen at practice and just talking to the staff, what's your impression of those guys and the impact they can make?
Well, Williamson, a local guy, he has a foot injury right now, foot or ankle injury, so he's going to be out for, you know, at least a couple more weeks. But Tyron Jones was a guy that they were very, very fortunate to keep. He was a player that committed under the previous regime. He's really, really close to DeShaun Henry, the ops director, so that's part of the reason why he stayed close to home. And he is a guy that has an NBA future. I mean, 6'9 with bounce. He's one of those guys when you're at practice, you will look over, you know, if you're kind of half paying attention, all of a sudden you just see a guy going up above the rim and just rattling the rim on a dunk. Tyron Jones is athletic. I would say as athletic as anybody on the roster. I mean, he separated his shoulder probably 2 months ago, had a minor surgery, and he's expected to go on Tuesday in the scrimmage. That'll be his first college action, and then likely ready to go on opening night on the 4th. He has the probably the most bounce on the team in terms of overall vert, and he may have the highest potential in terms of the athleticism of any single player on the roster.
Candy Cofield, Golden Circle Sports Bar. I'll tell you, Adam Candy, as a veteran play-by-play guy like you are, Matt Neverett's got some pressure on him this season because I've seen Matt around his father, Tim, who, of course, is the voice of the Dodgers, and I can only imagine if my father were a sports talk radio host, giving me advice, I don't think I would – I'd probably tell him, all right. But I've seen it with you guys, with Tim and you, Matt. Now – we should announce here, and I got the clearance from the higher ups that there's gonna be a little different look during the non-con home games, where there's gonna be a different broadcast crew on radio, and then for Silver State Sports and Entertainment / Mountain West, you're gonna be the TV guy in play-by-play, and who's doing radio play-by-play?
It'll be Big Tim himself.
Hello, going back in time.
No, it should be fun. Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. I am looking forward to it. They're sliding Curtis and I over to the TV side. And don't short yourself now. You'll be the analyst on radio with him, so you'll be the one that's actually sitting next to him. Maybe, you know what, Steve? I'll text you things to tell him like he does to me during our football broadcast. How about that?
Wouldn't that be great if I gave him tips? And I'm like, no, there's just tips. I don't like where you are right now, Tim. You've been doing a lot of baseball.
Yeah.
You gotta. I just wanted you to pass a message on to him. I'm very Romo-like when I analyze. I need a lot of space.
Hey, that's fine. You know, I've gotten enough of a precursor. And if he doesn't do a good enough job, you know, there's always a different guy we could bring in.
I don't need any space. I stumble and bumble and mention a couple of things about some things I've observed. But now I'm really excited to have Team Neverett. I think the fans should be really excited to hear them both on TV and on the radio side. We should make one mention at least of what you think the Rebel football team is working on. I think the obvious thing is coming up with some solutions for what's been happening on defense. Are you optimistic that there's going to be a scheme change? Is there personnel changes? There's not going to be a coaching change, but what's going to happen with this defense in these final five games to get going back in a good direction and get to where they want to go, which is make the Mountain West Conference title game, certainly finish the season with 9 or 10 regular season wins?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting conundrum they found themselves in here in a bye week, and I don't know if the vibes on social media have ever been lower for a 6-1 UNLV team after the game last week. Keep in mind, third straight year they're going bowling. Things are going well in the Fertitta football complex. The issue is on defense. I don't think it's a personnel issue. I mean, they've got some really, really talented players who have found a scheme and a home, really, after bouncing around to a couple of different schools in a couple of different years. I think it may be just overcomplicating things. I would not be surprised to see UNLV, especially against New Mexico next week, go with a simplified man-on-man concept for the majority of the game. They go back and forth between man and zone a little bit too much, in my opinion, with the bodies they've got. I think they've got a physical edge and a speed edge just about everywhere on the defensive side. Now, I think if that defensive line can do a really good job of getting into the backfield and wreaking havoc against the Lobos next week, I think that's going to be the big-time difference, because the man-on-man coverage has actually been pretty good. It's been miscommunications in zone, and they've been burned on a lot of plays with motion. I think that's going to be the big thing, too, is just that communication when the other team motions. We saw Air Force do it a lot like they do. Boise State felt like they were motioning on every play, and it led to some big-time mismatches. I would not be surprised to see New Mexico follow that same game plan, and I would very much not be surprised to see UNLV really, really simplify things, go with some man coverages, and I think they blitz a little bit more as well against New Mexico.
I want to go back to what you said there at the beginning, Matt, about, look, anyone who is stuck with UNLV through the years on the football side, I'm not about to call spoiled. That being said, 6-1 is 6-1.
I first started watching this team long before you were born, and the idea that anyone would ever be upset about a bowl-eligible team in October, and you have this history as well with this program, is just wild to me, and I think it actually says quite a bit about how far UNLV football has come, that people have the gall to be upset about 6-1.
How dare they, right? I mean, anyone that's been around the team for like 8 years, you don't even have to go that far back, can see how much the goalposts have moved. And it's kind of been a slow build up to it. They got the money with Sanchez. They started building a lot of the big facilities, and Allegiant got built in the Arroyo era. Then Barry Odom kind of elevated it to what, you know, a big-time Division I program should look like, both on and off the field. And then Dan Mullen, the biggest profile name that they've had coaching this team since John Robinson, swoops in and just kind of picks up where that momentum left off. And, yeah, would you like to be 7-0? Yes. Would you like to have had a win against Boise State for the first time since America's Bicentennial? Even more, yes. You didn't. You can't. You got to move on. And I think that the bye week, while it's a perfect time for the players to sit there and ruminate on this and rest their body, could not have come at a worse time for the fans, because all they're doing is sitting there and stewing and getting into it with Boise State writers on social media, right?
Matt, you're the man. Enjoy the World Series. We will see
you
soon.
Dodgers in five.
I really can't keep track of the schedule anymore. Well, are you going to get to a Dodger game? Are you going to have time?
I would have had time Monday. Doesn't look like I'm going to be able to get out there. But, hey, I was at the one game they've lost so far all postseason, so it's probably for the best that I'm not out there.
The jinx. All right, Matt. Thanks, buddy.
Happy to help.
There he is. Matt Nevert. He did help. He got a little big for his britches there, I thought. Saying that UNLV is switching too much on defense between man and zone. I have weird thoughts. So I went into kind of coach mode, and I was thinking, like, oh, okay, Coach Nevert, switching too much on defense. Then I thought, because I want to, you know, I'm always coming up with these really stupid Uncle Steve jokes. I was like, maybe we need to get Matt Nevert some bike shorts. And I don't mean like 90s bike shorts. I'm talking Hank Stram 1974 bike shorts. The shorts, Candy, if you watch Porky's, remember Mrs. Ballbreaker? Those shorts. They're unsightly. They're gross, but it makes me think of an old grizzled veteran coach. That could be a kind of a jokey holiday gift for Nevert. Until I looked up what they cost, I'm not buying these. They actually still make these. Bike Athletic. You remember these shorts? Did you wear these back in the day?
Although I thought you were having a mini stroke there for a minute. But yeah, I do remember. You remember the shorts. It's quite interesting. Look, if you want Coach to go out there to practice looking like Coach, then you got to get him the shorts.
Yeah. Bike Athletic shorts. $46. They don't cover a lot. Well, I do want quality, but they don't cover a lot. If you have thighs that have not seen the sun, that's not going to be good. But I will say, if you have a belly that hangs over, that you can pull them kind of high. That was the unique thing about the bike shorts, is that old school football coaches would wear those, and I'm like, they can't think this looks good.
I don't think they really cared whether it looks good. I think that's what was in the equipment room. Like, they just walked into the equipment room, and they're like, those look like shorts. Hot out today. I'm going to get those. You got these in a 42 Husky? Like, okay, thank you.
Did you're rail thin. Was there a time when you wore a Husky?
Oh, listen, I can remember so clearly in third grade having to wear the Husky pant. Like, when we went to the store and did the back-to-school shopping, I'm like, what do you mean Husky? Husky. And then I shot up. And don't forget, Steve Cofield, I once was a boy filled with juicy filth himself. It was not that many years ago that I weighed about 50 pounds more than I do right now. So I got to partake in a little bit of the good stuff for a while.
What was your peak weight?
Top? 230.
Whoa!
I know. You wouldn't look at all this svelte goodness and think to yourself, wow, 230 pounds on that frame. I want to hang clothes on him now, not meat.
You really were filled with juicy filth. That's the term of the day.
Yes. Hot dogs in boiling in my stomach.
Yes. All right, on the way back, we got to get to some of the media reaction. Well, it's really the talking head reaction to the NBA betting scandal. And I knew this would be the ultimate test for these guys on Inside the NBA. And I'm telling you, we got multiple clips from one of them just failing and flopping and saying just pure stupidity when it comes to what's going on with the NBA, the FBI, and those guys over there, the Mafia.
Hanging at the Golden Circle Sportsbook and Bar inside Treasure Island, it's Cofield and Company.
Looky here, Blake Snell running into some trouble. Although just threw a wicked freaking pitch to get a second strike, but bases loaded. Bottom of the first. Jays very much threatening. I do have to point out Adam Candy, who is the company today here at Golden Circle Sports Bar on a Friday edition of Football Friday. That's when Football Fridays are, yeah. So I got distracted with a can of corn in the center field, so Dodgers get out of it. I do have to say, though, Matt Nevert a couple minutes ago, I think really shortchanged our guy Alejandro Kirk, saying that he was 5'9", 250. I've talked about his official weight being 5'8", 275. I will amend that to he looks a little thinner tonight, 5'8", 272. Check that, 282. Because as we know, Aaron Judge is 6'7", 282. So wouldn't it be a hoot if Judge and Kirk did tip the scales at identical weights?
Be fantastic. P.S. he called him 5'6", which is even worse. It's even worse. Called Alejandro Kirk 5'6". Let me add this to the pot, Cofield. If you can do what Alejandro Kirk does, or what David Wells did, or
yep,
good old Rich Garces, if you could do what those guys did, aren't you an even better athlete than Aaron Judge? Like, you can overcome just how rotund you are and how little physical capability you have to have the skill to play this sport.
Kirk, at whatever he is, has actually legged out triples, which is a sight to behold. He's a meatball rolling around the bases at 270-plus pounds. He really is one of my favorite players. I love the guy, and I do appreciate just how good he is. And it's actually one of the unique things about baseball that there are players come in all shapes and sizes, and while guys get bigger and bigger and bigger, there's still room for the Kirks and the Jose Altuves of the world. All right. We'll get to some more football leans and likes before we get out of here on this Football Friday. But this is day two of this NBA poker FBI scandal that involves Chauncey Billups and Damon Jones, Terry Rozier, Jontae Porter. And when something as nuanced as sports gambling comes up, and now you've got a federal investigation, so now you've got law enforcement, you got legal stuff to get into, and frankly, I say it often on the air, Candy, we have multiple attorneys on the air because on this show, because I ain't one and you ain't one, and we know Adam Hill wants to be one, but he's not. Many things in the sports world that people don't understand can be explained when you speak to an attorney because there are legal aspects of things, which is why when many people are getting their opinions and forming their own opinion or getting information and then forming their own opinion, trying to, from Charles Barkley, it's a very dangerous world we live in. I'm telling you. And these are the situations. I know Chuck loves this. It's like, hey, I get to go in, and now I'm going to opine. And I'm sure he's saying to himself, I've thought about this for a full 2 minutes, and I've got stuff to say. And Barkley yesterday was just spewing nonsense. I appreciate the fact that he will take on anyone and go after anything, but listen to him yesterday as he's got Shams, NBA insider, on, and I guess he's trying to get Shams to throw Adam Silver under the bus. Fire this?
You know, 2 years is a long time to investigate somebody, and he was cleared. So, Shams, clearly the NBA dropped the ball. Now, you can make all the excuses saying they didn't have all the information that the FBI had. Adam Silver can pick up the phone and call the FBI and say, hey, do y'all really have something? The NBA dropped the ball. Bottom line, yes or no?
Adam Silver can pick up the phone and ask the FBI if they have something. Is that the way the FBI and law enforcement works on year-long investigations, Adam Candy?
Not to my knowledge. And as a journalist, let me tell you, the single hardest thing anywhere is getting law enforcement to tell you anything about an ongoing investigation.
Well, that would potentially blow the investigation, wouldn't it? And when you've got an operation nothing but net and you've come up with that name, you don't want to blow it. So if there are people watching, Chuck, and it's like, Silver, come on, man, make a couple of phone calls. And you did a two-year investigation. What's the problem? Why couldn't you match the investigation of the FBI? Here's Shams trying to answer it.
Well, Chuck, I'm told the NBA got access to Terry Rozier's phone. He had to forfeit his phone. That's the same thing Malik Beasley, from my understanding, has had to do with the NBA and with federal investigators. Yeah, the NBA didn't find enough evidence there, but the FBI is under no jurisdiction to have to share their information with the NBA. Clearly, the way this was done by Kash Patel and federal investigators that started in the Eastern District of New York, this was done in a silo. This was done closed mouth between all those sides, and I don't know how much they were able to share or even shared with the NBA.
Yeah, I do. Almost nothing. So for everyone out there who's like, why didn't the NBA figure this out? Yeah, they don't have subpoena power. They don't have a legal arm or an enforcement arm with dozens, if not hundreds, of people. What is Chuck talking about? I mean, I know it's easy to go, oh, you know what, I'm going to blame the NBA. Like, stop.
Cofield, how often do we talk about this when it comes to criminal cases like domestic violence or hit and runs or other things where Roger Goodell and the NFL suddenly decide, we're going to show up and do our investigation? What exactly are you going to do that law enforcement can't do? What are you going to do better or differently than law enforcement has done? Now, this is obviously a massive scale, much bigger than those isolated incidents that we're talking about here, but the point is no different. What is it that the NBA was going to do here that was going to either supersede or outdo the FBI? And by the way, had they found something, that wouldn't have gotten in the way of anything that was happening at the FBI level. This still would have come down the way that it was.
The other thing with Chuck that can be infuriating is, and we saw it last night, talking about addictions and sickness and how could Chauncey Billups and Porter and Damon Jones and Terry Rozier fall into this, be so selfish? And one of my favorite guys on the internet, and I don't know outside of Memphis that anyone knew the dude, but he just turns on his phone, Doc Holliday, who played a little bit in the NFL, was a running back at Memphis. He's been a longtime TV sports guy. And he will go at people. And what he says here about Barkley having no forgiveness for anyone, just throwing out an opinion that everyone is a knucklehead. I can't do the accent. I can't do the impression. But listen to Doc Holliday talk about Chuck and giving out opinions and not really trying to be very understanding of how people get into stitches like this.
Another thing on Chuck Barkley, he doesn't like to give people grace, I see. He's very disrespectful with a lot of things he says about players and former players. And he doesn't like to give people the same grace that he was afforded and that he's still afforded when he was making all those mistakes coming up. Spitting on little girls, gambling a lot, fighting a lot, bragging about not being a role model, saying he'll work for the KKK if they paid him enough. And over and over and over again, when he was dealing with weight issues, when he was playing, but he makes fun of Zion Williamson when Zion was dealing with weight issues. And he just doesn't give people the same kind of grace that he was afforded.
I understand things are about headlines and flamboyant statements and hot takes, Candy, but this is the kind of story that is so layered there needs to be some nuance, and sometimes not everyone in the room should be speaking on it as if they're an expert. And by the way, I'm describing myself. I'm not an expert, so I will try to bring – I mean, you've been great the last couple of shows on this whole gambling thing. I don't know what you know. I don't work in that field. That's why we have attorneys on. Sometimes it's like you don't have to speak if you don't really know what you're talking about.
I don't agree with everything Doc said there about Barkley, because I don't think Barkley's ever been asking for grace. Barkley doesn't seem to care about whether he gets the grace or not. But the other side of what we talked about with the NBA gambling scandal with Barkley is what he talked about last night was Kenny Smith was talking about, well, some of these guys might be compulsive gamblers, right? Some of these guys might have problems. And Barkley kind of dismissed that out of hand. And I don't know that I would be so quick to dismiss these things out of hand when we know that a guy like Jonte Porter had significant gambling debts, and that's how he got tied up in all of this. Like, and those are facts that we know for sure.
Coming up, we'll have a couple bites from a former mobster who was very much involved in, you know, schemes like this where they were suckering, you know, average Joes, people off the street, athletes to get involved in games like this, and you know, that turn into major scandals and people get hurt and they lose money, and sometimes the worst happens.
Now back to Cofield and Company, live at the Golden Circle Sportsbook and Bar inside Treasure Island.
All right, Shohei up with the bases loaded. Dodgers out to a 1-0 lead, top of the second. We'll get you an update on what Ohtani does in this sitch. But before that, caller 7 right now. Unique opportunity, 364-1100, 364-1100. Foo Fighters are going to be playing Vegas in 2026. We've got tickets now before you can buy them. James is going to hook you up. It's September 2026. Early lead on the tickets. You get them before you can buy them. 364-1100, caller number 7, 364-1100. And mark it on your calendar. Foo Fighters coming to Vegas in 2026. So, Candy, we got bases loaded, two outs. This young pitcher trying to get out of the situation. Hernandez played at Hernandez earlier. Dodgers have a 1-0 lead.
I am not surprised that Kike Hernandez was front and center and doing something good in the playoffs. Tends to happen a lot.
Let's go in the bag.
Cofield and Company presents Grab Bag on ESPN Las Vegas.
Ohtani grounds out, so they get out of the inning. Only one run plated, so minimize the damage, 1-0. Dodgers have the lead going to the bottom of the second. So we were talking yesterday, Candy, about Mountain West Conference Basketball Media Day and if San Diego State and UNLV men's hoops should continue their series. And as it turns out, they are going to continue it. I guess Brian Dutcher wasn't fibbing when he said they were really trying. As next year, so 2026, in the fall, they will start playing every year, swapping back and forth at the home arena. So if I can speak English, San Diego State will host the first game, and then in 2027, UNLV will host San Diego State. So like I said, I'm open to it. I just think UNLV should not reserve many spots for any Pac-12 opponents. I think they have to really zone in on making sure that they beef up the schedule a lot, because this new Mountain West will be solid for basketball, but it's not going to be great. And you only have so many slots in the non-con. They got to be aggressive and take on Power Four plus Big E schools.
So let me ask you this, though. San Diego State's a program that no matter what conference they're in, that's a consistent top 50 net program, right? Like, yeah. It's not going to hurt you necessarily to have them on the schedule.
I just don't think. Well, I mean, there's media attention and fan attention versus actually using the numbers. Does San Diego State get the respect it should by the selection committee? I believe the answer is no. I think they're underseeded pretty much every time out. I don't think they've earned anything by going to the national finals, the national championship game a couple years ago. So that's my whole point. I think so much of this is optics, and college basketball has decided, hey, these are the power conferences. They've let the, you know, the Big East somehow is part of the five because they have, you know, a little bigger budgets than some of the mid-majors. So, and I think the other part of it is if San Diego State were a great mid-major that was in the Midwest South or Northeast, I think it would get a lot more attention and a lot more respect. It should be respected. It absolutely is a top 50 program every year by the net, but I don't think the tournament selection committee treats it that way and will treat teams that play San Diego State that way.
Makes sense to me because you want to also play games that people see, right? You want to play games that are visible. And that's the biggest thing, I think, for UNLV is as this program tries to ascend, even if you play San Diego State every year, a lot of times the people who matter are asleep when you do.
Back in the bag.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
You see your boy Dolan's all mad because Mom Dami has... I mean, if you look at his logo, it is absolutely... a facsimile of the Knicks logo, but we know that the Knicks, and especially Dolan, loves cease and desist and threatening legal action. So he's got a logo. He's running for mayor. It seems like a waste of time to me by the Knicks, but I guess Dolan's picking his side in this thing, huh?
You know, I'm going to end the show talking about Juicy Filth as well, because that's what I feel overwhelming me as I have to say something positive about Dolan. He's right. The logo is pretty obviously a ripoff of the Knicks logo. Yes. And I don't know that I want to get involved in the New York City mayor's race right now, especially I wouldn't imagine that Jim Dolan and Mom Domney have the same politics. So, yeah, Jim was actually right. Ugh.